is us like learning in public and like trying to
literally learning in public.
Yeah.
We were at Vancouver Public Library. Yes. There are glass doors. Yes. We are literally learning in public.
Pulling back the curtain of silence.
And learning what freedom feels like. I'm Nick.
And I'm Lala. This is Seen. Brown-eyed activism.
Healing at the intersections.
It's natural for feelings of inadequacy to wax and wane. And I think all of us are likely familiar what it means to feel like we're not enough, like we're not doing enough, like we're never going to be enough. And as some listeners, and certainly you, Lala, would know, I'm a lover of astrology. And, you know, my Aquarius sun kind of keeps me, I would say, like looking kind of into the future and like dreamy. And my Gemini moon kind of gifts me with like this need to like communicate and like learn and like expand my knowledge. And I would say my Scorpio rising is something that I'm still figuring out. It's very powerful. It's very like mystical and emotional, as most water signs seem to be. But I've realized over keeping journals for many, many years and like looking back and reflecting on some of the things that I would write about, where I was at or what had changed. It's kind of fun. I like doing that a lot. I have like 3 journals since I was, I think I have one from like 9th grade. So it's fun to like read back and think about who I was then. But one theme that has been really clear in, you know, past journals, current journals, has been this feeling of inadequacy. So today I'm really grateful that, I don't know, the universe or spirit or whatever, has really put on my heart this topic, because it's really deeply personal. Like it feels, I'm feeling like excited, but also anxious to talk about this with you. And I think it's, you know, I always say this, so I think it loses like its meaning. I'm like, it's really timely. but I think it's timely, just given the increased amounts of sort of daily information that we're consuming and witnessing and experiencing, and this burning feeling that I think a lot of us have to like do more. So yeah, I hope in sharing where I've been and where I'm at and being in discussion with you, Lala, we can kind of strip things down to explore, you know, all the facets of not doing enough, like performativity, and I think like ideological like purity and worthiness and rules and like just the ways that we judge one another, and all of that. So before I, you know, begin and introduce our BIPOC of the week, because we don't do spoilers, no spoilers, Lala, I just want to know how you're feeling entering in this conversation today. How are you?
Yeah, I'm excited to talk about this. I'm nervous. I don't know if it's in the same way, but I think these are just really difficult issues. And I think there is a lot of, I don't know, reactivity around them. Like we all, I think, carry a lot of wounds in different ways, like whether it's our own fears and our own inadequacy, but also like the ways that other people have treated us and hurt us, and the reasons why, you know, some of these things we're going to talk about today, the ideological purity and things like that, I think there's reasons why these things have developed in the ways that they have in our groups. And so I'm really aware too of like the wounding and harm that's led to that, you know, both like personally, I'm like aware of, well, but if I don't hold on to this, when this person does this and this person does this, you know, like that kind of thing. So
yep.
I think it's a really important conversation, and I'm just so aware of how loaded it is in a lot of ways too.
Thank you. Thank you. It's so loaded. It is. I like what you just said about how it's about how we've experienced hurt sometimes, and that dance you do between like the traumas you have and other people's, and they're within our communities too. Like I'm speaking specifically of like the spaces that we take up, not even because I don't know what other people are doing. So I appreciate that you are also feeling this kind of like, oh, I'm excited. And I think this conversation is important, but also it's challenging and loaded.
Yes.
Completely. Yeah. So our, no spoilers, our BIPOC of the week is Francis Lee, a writer, speaker, and environmental justice and communication strategist of Chinese descent who has been organizing in the Seattle area for, I think, like over a decade. I came across Francis' work like just through Google searching, like social justice, not enough. And it kind of led me to their work. So pieces of writing and offerings that Francis Lee has created include Excommunicate Me from the Church of Social Justice.
Oh, they wrote that. Okay. I remember yeah. when that made the rounds a couple years ago.
Yeah. Why We Need Imperfect Apologies, No Justice Without Love, Why Activism Must Be More Generous, and an anthology called Towards an Ethics of Activism, a Community Investigation of Humility, Grace, Compassion in Movements for Justice. And that piece features contributions from Dean Spade, Corinne Manning, Alicia Garza, and a lot of other really radical, awesome folks. So today we'll be drawing specifically from Towards an Ethics of Activism, that anthology, and No Justice Without Love. So Francis Lee's work challenges and affirms me at the same time, because they kind of express this clear tension between our like ideological and like, I guess, visions of what we want the world to be like, and the goals of like building power and dismantling systems of violence, and the ways that we go about doing that, and how in the process of trying to do those aspirational like movement making pieces of work, a lot of us are left hurting, despite our commitments to like minimizing harm and being trauma informed and all these kinds of ways of being that a lot of us are like, yeah, that's dope. I really want that. So kind of similar to what you were saying in terms of like this being loaded, I just want to start off with a disclaimer, because I think this conversation is uncomfortable. Like, I feel uncomfortable talking about this. And Lee states very clearly that we should always want to continue to be like critical and to have conversations about power and cultural appropriation and, you know, impact versus intent. But they also write that we should be asking ourselves, you know, as social justice oriented workers and activists and organizers and community members, how can we treat each other with more care? Lee says that they believe in yes and methods of social justice work. So yes, a historical system of oppression operates in our society that results in mass inequity and harm. And we all have the capacity to recognize the humanity in each other to forge genuine connections. So I guess to start things off, I wanted to ask you, have there been times in your life where you felt like you weren't doing enough of the work? Air quotes around all those things.
Absolutely. I mean, it's a question I ask myself all the time, and it definitely comes up for me sometimes. And there were certainly long periods of time where I absolutely felt that I wasn't. And we've talked about this before, but I think especially because there is certain roles that are very much kind of lauded as the best ones or the most important ones. And not being like an organizer, I felt like I wasn't doing anything, and not being able to go to things in person because of physical and mental health has often made me feel like I'm not doing enough. And I've always known that my physical and mental health were in the way, but then also still felt really like ashamed and defensive and sort of like, maybe it's just an excuse and I bet other people have like worse things that they're dealing with and they still go, and you know, those kinds of things. So that's come up for me a lot.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, for sure. Yeah, absolutely. Like, I would be lying to you and the universe and myself if I said no. Like, I on a almost daily basis am feeling like I'm not doing enough, and I feel like I'm not doing enough real activism. Yeah. And I also am just like, what does that even mean? You know, I want to unpack that a little bit of like, what do we mean when we're saying like, I'm not doing enough, like real work, all air quotes again around mm-hmm. these things. And I've definitely felt that way when I wasn't doing paid work that aligned with my values, like kind of like, oh, you know, I feel like I'm contributing to harm because I'm not like walking the walk to like the fullest extent, if that mm-hmm. makes sense. And yeah, I've just been like you were talking about, really judgmental of myself. And I know that we discussed in our episode on shame, if we're in like this mental frame of mind where, you know, you're just judging yourself and it just keeps you feeling stuck, you know, like, mm-hmm. and if you're like me and you, you know, are journaling, and like my journal is filled with things like, and I quote, this is kind of embarrassing, but you know, sharing, why can't I just show up? Why can't I look more activist-y? I literally wrote that. Why am I so complicit? Like things like that, that just made me like, obviously to write that out, it's like, I deeply felt like I'm not doing enough. And on top of all those things, it's like from the outside looking in, people have told me like, you do so much, you know what I mean? So, but it's like, so somehow I'm still, yeah, like there's still some, there's definitely like a lot of judgments. And I guess I'm curious if you know where your judgments for yourself come from, like where that has stemmed along. Like it sounds like, you know, in the times where you haven't been able to like physically be somewhere because of chronic illness or because of like your health, and you're kind of feeling the results of like ableism, you know what I mean? Where it's like, well, you're not doing it because your body's not there physically.
Mm-hmm, definitely. And yeah, so ableism, capitalism. And I was just, my family culture was very much, you do what you're supposed to do no matter what. And it doesn't matter how you feel. You're just supposed to do the thing that you're supposed to do. No excuses. And that if you didn't or couldn't do that, then it was because of, you know, some kind of like moral failure. So I think that was something I really internalized. And I think that comes from, again, like that's so related to capitalism and ableism and white supremacy and all of those things. So I think I really felt that in my family and then also in the outer world. So it just became so internalized. And it's such an easy default. Like I've worked hard to get away from that, but like I can still feel the ways it's still like hooked into me, and it's like really easy to get kind of triggered back into that feeling.
Yes. I mean, obviously we've had such different experiences, but I hear you and feel you. You just do things even if you don't feel like doing them, even if it like literally like harms you to do it, you still do it because that's what is expected of you. And I think those expectations are definitely what has caused me to feel like, well, damn, I don't even know if I have reasonable expectations of myself. And so anyways, thank you for that. Because yeah, it's like family, but also like the systems around you, not just like the personal interactions you have with people who are like caring for you or, you know, loving you or supporting you and your family, but it's like, it's external as well. Mm-hmm. And so Francis gave me some ideas that really affirmed and validated what I was thinking of in terms of like where the judgment comes from, especially that external judgment that you're speaking to when it comes to like capitalism and ableism. So in No Justice Without Love, Lee writes, as an intersectional activist who is concerned about the future of our movements, I'm really worried that social justice activism in the West is stuck in a dangerous state of disrepair. Ideological purity has become the norm. Social justice movements, which were originally about freeing marginalized people from oppressive institutions and social structures, have become imbued with their own narrow framework and morality. Our knowledge base is made up of reactionary think pieces, self-righteous social media posts, romanticized narratives of movement histories, and prescriptive checklists of how to stop being problematic. Activists who are deemed woke are praised and accepted, while others who are judged not to possess a sufficiently layered analysis of power and oppression on the axis of race, gender, sexuality, and disability are demeaned or excluded. In many social justice communities, fear and shame are regularly used to control other people's behavior and shut down contentious discussions. So I guess I'm wondering, with that quote, what struck you? Was there anything that made you go, I don't know? Or was there anything that resonated?
I think what really comes up for me is the elitism of all of it and how we expect people to have certain language and approach things a certain way, and it's really easy to discount them if they don't. So do you know the song A Tribe Called Red by Angel Hayes?
I think so, yes.
Yeah, and at the beginning she's saying, people ask her, why doesn't she talk about where she's from and where she grew up and like, you know, who her people are and that kind of thing. And then she says, I don't identify with that shit. Like everything you need to know is in the music. And there's some people who've made the criticism of like, oh, that's like this apolitical, like not wanting to, you know, to really take on the issues and like, you know, we need to have this group consciousness and things like that. And I felt like, well, if this person who's Black and Indigenous and queer and genderqueer is saying something, maybe we should listen about why is she saying that? Like, maybe there's something we can learn and maybe we don't ultimately agree with her. But I also think, like, we talk so much about lived experience and we prize it so much. And yet, like, if somebody says that their experience is different, we're so afraid of that.
Yeah. Yes, absolutely. What I'm hearing you say in this example with Angel Hayes is that, like, we have this almost checklist of, like, well, you're supposed to say it like this. Like, this is, you should be able to speak to that. Like, when asked about it as, like, a good social justice, I'm just using these terms, like, mm-hmm. I don't know, as, like, a good social justice, like, advocate or, like, somebody who's, like, an activist or who's political and conscious, like, you're supposed to be able to speak to those things and you shouldn't shy away from them. And it's, like, I think so much of it is a projection of what we think is, like, the right way to live out our politics and the right way to come to personal healing and collective liberation and how we're supposed to show that, like, what that's supposed to look like to other people.
Yeah, and I guess to me, again, like, that example and the quote you just read, it makes me think again about how I've experienced judgment and shame as sort of two sides of the same coin. It's like, judgment, and we need to be discerning, like, we need to be able to tell the difference between something that feels supportive and something that feels harmful, for example. So I'm not saying, like, any kind of discernment or judgment is wrong, but I think there's a way that we sometimes approach other people that is the mirror image of the shame that we have for ourselves. And I think they're very tied, that, like, we are so afraid of saying the wrong thing or being caught having the wrong opinion. And then, you know, the other side of that is trying to make ourselves feel right by pointing out how wrong other people are, because we're so afraid of that feeling of being wrong ourselves.
Absolutely. You're skipping way ahead in my thing, but I'm like, girl, this is exactly it. This is exactly, yeah. Like, I don't know. For me, I've, like, as a person who's, like, an empath and who feels deeply when, like, there's injustice or when people are hurting, and who is also, like, a communicative person, I felt like, okay, well, I know all this information, like, I need to share it. I need to, like, tell people, like, how I feel about these issues that I feel strongly about. And I think naturally that the most obvious, like, avenue for that is social media. And, you know, I mentioned before, like, there's this continued pressure to, like, you know, have to share more and contribute more and do more. But as we're thinking about the ways in which, like, what's motivating us to do those things, like, is it deeply because you care about that issue, or is it because we feel like if we don't do it, people are going to think differently about us or poorly about us or negatively about us? And like you're talking about, and like we said before, I think shame is such an unsustainable motivator to be the reason that we are sharing, for example, on social media or posting something on social media. Like, I just don't think that, I don't know, I just don't think that it's helpful. And then, like you just mentioned, the connection between judgment and shame. And I think there's, like, guilt, which Brené Brown has talked about like, how guilt can, and we've talked about this on the podcast, I know that you've said this specifically, mm-hmm. about how guilt can be this thing where we're like, okay, I feel guilty, now it's going to be, like, generative and help me kind of, like, right the wrong, or if, like, this doesn't feel right, I feel guilty, and how can I make it better? Whereas shame is, like, about the disconnect, about people, about feeling, like, scared or fearful that people are going to reject us. And yeah, I just think that you're right. There is such a distinct difference, and judgment can be helpful. But when it's, like, shame bound, it's like, if I don't post this thing, people are going to think that I'm a fraud. People are going to think that I don't care about something, you know. People are going to, you know, look to me and say, like, oh, she has this kind of privilege. Like, obviously she doesn't care about this thing because look at her. You know what I mean? Like, mm-hmm. I just feel like when the shame and the fear converge, it's, like, a really isolating place, because we end up doing things out of desperation to be acceptable to other people and to ourselves. Mm-hmm. Like, we kind of go, well, what does that say about me if I don't do it?
Totally. And I think this is where it gets really complicated, because I think that there can be a fear when we talk about this kind of thing that, like what the solution then is like, just let people off the hook. Like, don't,
right.
You know, like people, it's okay for people to just not engage with certain issues. Like, don't judge this person because they have like no awareness or don't do anything about transphobia, for example, or, you know, they're really like there for certain types of racism, but they have nothing to say about settler colonialism and whatever. That's fine. Like, not everybody can care about everything. I think that is the fear that like, that's where we're going with that, you know? And so it's complicated because, yeah, I totally agree that fear and shame are not healthy and sustainable ways to motivate us, and they're not the foundation on which we're trying to build this different system. Like, that's the system we live in now, is like basing everything from fear and shame, right? That's not what we're trying to build. But then we get scared that there isn't another way. I guess maybe this comes back to imagination of like, how can we not come from the fear and shame we're used to and still show up for each other and still have a way of, you know, talking to people about the ways that they're not showing up for everybody else in this coalition that we're trying to build.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah, I think the imagination piece, I'm thinking about that in terms of like antidotes for feeling like we're not enough. And we'll get into that kind of later on. But it reminds me of like Audre Lorde saying like, the master's tools will never dismantle the master's house. It's like, well, like we can't use the same tools and ways of doing things that folks who we identify as like our oppressors or people who are complicit or supportive of systems that harm us are using to harm us. Like, that can't be reproduced. And for us to expect a different result, I think is foolish, in my opinion. I'm curious what you think about this. Like, you know, I've begun for myself to just like realize that I don't want to be spending so much energy focused on what other people aren't doing, that I'm leaving so little time to focus on what I can do, what I need, how I need to meet those needs when it comes to personal healing and collective liberation work. I wonder what you think about that. Like, not like the completely like mind my own business, like, you know, stay in my own lane, and like not be concerned with how folks maybe aren't showing up in ways that are supportive or contributing to the world that we're trying to build together, but really trying to spend a fraction of that energy on focus on other people and more so turning inward.
Yeah, I think that makes a lot of sense, because I think if we're so focused on what other people aren't doing, that is really depressing. It's like a really depressing and like infuriating and like sad, lonely place to be in. And I think that the more we can focus on what we want to do, it feels more empowering. So we don't feel just so like helpless in this world of people not doing things. You know, we can feel more connected to that feeling of agency, or the feeling that, you know, I can do at least a little bit and that feels like something. Right. And I think it can also then help us to approach other people. Like, it's, I think, feels a lot better and easier to approach other people with like, this is what I'm doing. Like, hey, can I bring you in on this? Or can I get some help on this? Or like, how would you feel? Would you be able to support this? Rather than a sort of just on the outside judging.
Yes. Okay. So cool. We're on similar wavelengths. Cause I think this is where it gets uncomfortable to talk about, because I don't know, like, and I come back to social media a lot only because for me, that's been the biggest, it's been both like the lifeline for finding out information and community, but it's also been, and it continues to be like a battering ram in which we're like enacting violence both to ourselves, because we're like, look at this person's life. I don't have what they have. They're doing everything and I ain't shit. Or we're like, look at this person's life. They clearly don't know what's up because they haven't spoken about this thing, and that makes them a terrible person. And I think, I don't know, I just don't think that social media engagement and sharing and posting is like the best gauge for the healing or the work that you're doing, your community that you're actually engaged in. I think so much happens offline and in like internally to ourselves that never ends up making it to social media. But you know, in our other episode about how not to have trash politics, and we talked about, you had said, I think at the beginning, you're like, the rules are, there are no rules. Is that corny? And we were like, yeah, but it's true. Like, there are no rules.
This is quirky. Yeah, so, well, what can you do?
but I think, you know, we know that there are no rules, and we're so committed to, like, smashing this binary, like, in any way, shape, or form. We know that, like, binary ways of thinking are, like, harmful. People just give you, like, this is the one thing or this is the other thing. Like, you're kind of like, well, there's probably stuff in between and more to the story. And I think, I don't know, I just, as somebody who has watched and witnessed folks come at somebody, and speaking specifically of Beyoncé most recently, in the context of the anti-SARS movements that are taking place in Nigeria, but globally, and a lot of folks had a lot of things to say about how Beyoncé was, like, not doing enough or, like, saying anything about SARS. And then it, you know, comes to find out that Beyoncé does a lot of things in the background, and that's kind of the way that it seems like she moves in general. Like, she won't post about something, but she might, like, be funding things or doing things that are, like, not about, oh, this is what I'm up to, or this is what I, like, believe. But then she ended up posting about it. And I guess in the spirit of, you know, there are no rules, we have all kind of bought into this idea that, like, if you don't post about it on social media, you don't care about it. And it's like, well, I don't think that's true, and I don't think that's fair. And I think we hold ourselves personally, and then we project that standard to other people. And then I think it creates, like, really chaotic relationships, and we make assumptions about other people that we're in community with, because what we perceive is that they're not doing enough because they didn't, like, share something. And I think social media, it can be the gateway drug of, like, just really being terrible to one another, because we think, like, that is the standard of your engagement in this issue. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I totally do. And this just really makes me think about relationship building and what that looks like offline. And it just makes me wonder what all the things are that are getting in the way of that, because there's a lot of things kind of going into that. So I wonder, like, what is it that makes people angry or hurt or upset when they see people not posting on social media about a certain thing? And I think sometimes it's what we were talking about of, like, I can't tolerate the feeling of being wrong, and I really need to feel right. And the way I do that is by making other people wrong so I can feel self-righteous. But I think there's also a real pain for a lot of people who, you know, our society, our communities very much leave them behind. You know, they're living with a lot of marginalization, oppression. And, you know, they experience this lack of care in the world. And then social media is the primary way that we connect with each other right now, I think. Yeah. Well, certainly right now during the pandemic. Yeah. But even without the pandemic, I think it's a primary way that we all feel connected. And so when that seems to be duplicated, you know, it's like nobody's caring for me in my real life and then nobody's saying anything online. That's, I think a lot of pain comes from that.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So then I wonder, like, how do we do things differently, do things better so that people don't have to go to social media to feel cared for?
Yes, dude. I read somewhere, so in this anthology that I mentioned, Towards an Ethics of Love, I think it's Corinne Manning that writes about how calling people out is about grief. Like, it's really about you being like, you're not showing up for me in the way. Like, this really hurts me that you aren't. And that's where it's coming from. So, yeah, like, how can we go back to relationships with one another so that somebody doesn't have to rely on that snapshot of, you know, somebody's, I don't know, political beliefs or whatever, or something that somebody found interesting for the day that they shared on Twitter or Instagram or whatever, as the stand-in for, I care about you and I see you. Because I think sometimes we conflate the two things and say that, like, oh, by you posting about this thing, it means you obviously care about me. And I think, you know how in the lead up to the US elections, folks have been really critical about how voting alone obviously isn't the means of us, like, doing our part. Speaking about us, but we're not American, but it's not the means for Americans to do their part. It's like, it's a both and, always, like, this both and. And I think it's like, the more, like, I want to complicate this idea of social media, because of course there's going to be folks who cannot show up in real life because of you know, you're navigating disability or chronic illness and like being, or you're homebound. And it's like social media is the space where you're able to show up and do what you can. But I just think there's always more in between. So I'm really grateful that you mentioned about like how to be there in person, in community, even virtually, like one-on-one. Like the one-on-one relationships, I think, take such a back seat when it comes to doing the work mm-hmm. and like doing more. I think we always imagine it has to be like out there in the world for everyone to see. And it's like, well, maybe it's just between me and Lala. Like maybe it's just, it starts here, you know?
Yeah. And it just makes me think again about why emotional healing and, you know, the therapy work, and it doesn't have to be done in paid therapy, but that type of work, why it's so important for our social movements. Because to me, I mean, so much of what gets in the way of that are things like people being afraid to be that vulnerable. You know, it's a lot harder Absolutely. To call. So, I mean, it's hard for us, our generation and younger, I think, really struggle just to call someone on the phone at all.
So true.
But to then call and say, you know, I'm hurt about this, or I really need you to show up in this way, or, you know, these kinds of vulnerabilities. There's so many reasons why that's scary for us, or why, like, whether it's our feelings of it's not safe to be vulnerable, we haven't experienced that emotional safety in our relationships, or, you know, whether it's a fear of taking up too much space and we feel like we don't want to ask anyone for anything. There's so many things that get in the way, and I think a lot of it needs to be dealt with in more of a therapeutic and healing context. I mean, again, healing and liberation are so tied, but like we can't think our way out of this.
Thank you. Okay. So as you're saying about how we can't think our way out of this, I want to talk a bit about that thing that I shared with you from For Harriet. Yes. And I want to talk about performativity and what that means, because you're talking about vulnerability and being able to say like, hey, I need support, or actually, I don't know this thing. I don't know enough about this thing. Mm. I can't really speak to that or whatever. So recently I watched this video of a interview on the platform For Harriet, which is founded by Kimberly Foster. And she was having a conversation with Jenna Arnold. And Jenna Arnold was one of the co-founders of the US Women's March in 2017. She's a white woman. She's Jewish. And most of us know about the Women's March, specifically like Tamika Mallory. And anyway, so long story short, Jenna wrote this book. I don't remember the title of the book, but it's not very important in the context of this conversation. But her qualitative research and what she was doing with this book was like having conversations with white women as a white woman, these little like discussion circles. And, you know, she was speaking to women who identified as conservative, right wing, as well as like, you know, left wing, progressive folks as well. I found what she shared with Kimberly and on For Harriet, which you can go find the video. I thought it was super interesting. And I shared this with you. She said that she found in conversations with white conservative women, folks wasted really no time in asking questions about like things that they didn't understand. Like they spent maybe 10 minutes like doing introductions, and then they were like, so what's this like trans rights thing? I don't know. I don't understand it. And of course, like if you're hearing me say this right now, you're going to be like, well, fuck these people for not knowing what the fuck it is. Cause that was my initial response. I'm like, well, fuck you. But then she went on to talk about how these conservative white women didn't have as much vested interest in feigning wokeness and like pretending like they knew anything. Cause they were like, I vote this type of way, but I still want to know about this type of thing. Can you share that with me? Can you tell me what it is? I don't understand it. I don't know about it. Can you educate me? Whereas in conversations she had with white progressive women, it was kind of like that textbook example of why Martin Luther King Jr. was like, you know, don't trust the like white moderate, because she said that they didn't talk about what they didn't know. Everyone was so scared about saying the wrong thing, and everyone was so interested in being like, this is how much I know. And it was kind of one of those like, I have a black friend, like just kind of doing the like political like wink wink to like all the things that they knew, but they didn't get to the heart of discussing like, so how do we work together? How do we like go and talk to conservative white women? Because we obviously know things. What should we be doing? How can we be figuring this out? And I found that to be fascinating. And I know I shared this with you. Curious what your thoughts are. And I wonder if you think that that kind of, I don't want to say it's posturing. I don't want to say it's virtue signaling, but I wonder if that kind of way of relating to one another can exist within our racialized movements too, where we spend so much time like around the edges, but not getting to the heart of like, so who's being harmful to each other? Like, let's actually talk about real problems that we're facing, not to like spending all of our energy, perhaps like being upset about what people did or didn't do, but like, what are we doing? How can we focus on us right now? Mm-hmm. What do you think?
Yeah. And again, I think this is where the personal, you know, healing and emotional health and those kinds of things intersect with our liberation movements, because it is really valid if somebody comes to a space or, you know, just exists in the world and, you know, don't know anything about trans rights in 2020, I think it's valid for somebody to be angry and hurt about that.
Yes.
And I don't think they should have to swallow that in order to be in these spaces.
Right.
But I think that maybe there is like a, oh, fuck this person, like they can't be trusted, they should get out. When yeah. maybe what we need is things like, first of all, having the space to say, like, this is really hurtful that you don't know about this, and the person being able to have the space for that and to be like, okay, like, I can sit with the fact that my lack of attention to this subject has harmed people. Like, I yes. think we all need that emotional capacity. And mm-hmm. we need to show up for each other enough that it's not, you know, the trans folks who then have to, like, do all of the work of that. Yep. Like, both yes. the work of educating on trans rights and issues and the work of, you know, the emotional labor of, like, actually, that really sucks, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Like, just, I mean, I'm thinking back to, like, how you were able to express your pain in the summer around, like, all the white folks who were acting like, you know, oh, wow, like, I just realized that things are really hard for Black people. And that's, like, it was, right? That's so painful.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's important for those white people to hear that pain that they've caused.
Absolutely.
Without it having to be on you necessarily to, like, be the one to facilitate that work for them.
Thank you. Yes, 100% agree with what you're saying. 100% agree with what you're saying. There needs to be, we need to have within us the space, the emotional capacity, I guess, as, for example, as a cis woman, for me to be able to hear somebody who is a cis white woman, for example, asking questions about trans rights and not going to a trans person and saying, can you educate them? Can you tell them? But mm-hmm. for me, because I think a lot of the times, like, and now we're kind of getting into like talking about Puritanism and like just this like moral sort of virtue, like the standards that we have of ourselves and each other. I think a lot of the times, like within like our leftist communities, we who are not experiencing that level of like violence. So as a cis person, like I don't experience transphobia. We end up being like, I'm done with you. I can't talk to you, other cis person. Yeah. When you, it's like, well, that's actually my job. Like, yes. that's actually the work that I need to be doing. And I think, you know, when I talk about the puritanical ways of being, it's like we romanticize this path about how people are supposed to get to like political consciousness. And we romanticize like, and we gloss over where we're supposed to be, who are positioned to be in conversation with those folks who don't know. We're like, nah, I'm not about that. It's like, well, actually, I'm supposed to be about that. I'm supposed to be the one.
Yeah. Right? And again, to like, sorry to keep like being the therapist in this conversation.
Yes, but always.
At least for me, I've definitely noticed that, you know, when I try to have conversations with family members or people in my life, like used to be coworkers when I was in the service industry sometimes, or other people who have views that are really dangerous and harmful and bigoted.
Right.
Even if it's not about me, I find like my body goes into like fight or flight a lot of the time. And I think it's because as someone who experiences multiple systems of oppression, who's targeted by multiple systems of oppression, I'm so conditioned that I'm unsafe, you know, like that the person, this is a transphobic comment, which doesn't affect me personally, but it's probably also likely if they don't know that, then they probably also have, you know, these racist beliefs, or they probably also support rape culture in a lot of ways, or, you know, things like that. And so it can be really difficult, even if it's not us being targeted by the particular behavior. Yeah. And that's why it's so important for us to be doing that healing work, so that we know how to bring ourselves out of the fight or flight, or we're able to tolerate more of what feels scary and dangerous without running away from it. Mm-hmm. Because I think that's often what happens, is people think it's just too stressful for me. Like, that's, you know, where they take it is sort of like, well, I have to, you know, I have to prioritize my health and well-being, and this is too stressful. My heart pounds and it's scary and like I sweat and whatever else. I'm like, I can't put myself through that. And I do believe in prioritizing our health and well-being, but that means that we need to deal with the things that are making it feel so dangerous. Because, you know, if I'm a cis person, this person like in front of me saying this transphobic thing, I'm actually not in danger 99% of the time, right? So I have to do that work to like teach my system, like, no, we can do this.
Mm-hmm. Because I think when we don't teach ourselves, like, I'm thinking about the end result. Let's say en masse, all of us cis people are like, no, we can't talk to the transphobic people about why they're transphobic. Frances Lee talks about how, like, the results of people being in communities with us, and one, I think it's important to realize that, like, if people are being harmful, they should be held accountable for the harmful things that they're doing. But I think sometimes we just skip to, like, kicking somebody out or ostracizing that person or saying, like, no, you're totally wrong and you're stupid and these are the, you know what I mean? Like, we go down this other route where it's actually just, like, and I'm going to say this, and I'm curious about what you think, but Lee talks about this pattern of folks leaving movements and communities, and how this is like counterproductive because movements need critical masses of people to function in the ways they're, we're actually going to transform systems of power. And like the critical mass thing is such an important end goal. Like, it's such an important thing for us to strive towards, because it doesn't help us any if we're not able to build power as people who are marginalized or fighting against systems of marginalization. That's not how we win. We don't win by being fractured. We win by being like a critical mass movement, you know? But I think oftentimes we're so hell-bent and holding on to these ideals and rules of how we think things should be that we don't know how to discern, like you were saying, between this makes me feel uncomfortable and my heart is pounding and I'm sweating, but I also know that 99% of the time as a cis person, I'm not going to experience transphobia, so I need to be able to tolerate those pieces. Like, I just think we don't know how to discern a lot of the times, like, all those nuances to keep us remaining in the conversation. I'm not saying remaining in community with somebody, because if somebody's going to say transphobic shit, I don't want to be in community with you, but I want you to understand and to know how what you're saying is harmful. And I think in that, if I have the capacity as a cis person to have a conversation with somebody who is perhaps completely terrible and harmful, and like me saying something to them won't change their mind anyways, or to having a conversation with somebody and saying what you're saying is harmful and here's why, and perhaps that being an opportunity for that person to step closer into doing less harm. Like, I just think sometimes we don't know how to like balance all of those different pieces of like, how do we build collective power? How do we call people out? How do we call people in? How do we minimize harm, but also hold survivors at the center? Like, there's just so much.
There is so much. And I think, I don't know, something that came up for me while you were talking was, what does it mean to be in community with each other? You know, where you said, I don't want to be in community with somebody if they're going to say transphobic shit, but I want to be in conversation. And I think of like, what does it mean to be in community? Because I think this is the whole point, is that we think being in alignment with our values means, okay, you say transphobic shit, you're out. And sometimes, yes,
yeah,
they should be. And we have to think about protecting the trans folks among us. Like, that needs to be centered and first and foremost always considered. And so, yeah, I don't want trans folks to feel unsafe in their communities, and that maybe sometimes that does mean asking somebody to leave. And at the same time, I think the whole point is that if we're not having, we're not doing the long and difficult work of bringing someone around, then what are we doing? Especially like as cis people in that example, like I'm thinking of a white woman that I'm friends with in the United States, in Pennsylvania, actually. And she worked as a nanny. And so after, you know, leading up to the 2016 election as well, and then after, she was doing a lot of work just daily to try to get other white women to understand why supporting Trump was so wrong. And like that, I mean, yeah, I don't want to be in community with Trump supporters. Like, are you kidding me? Like, if people don't realize why it's not okay to support Trump, like my first instinct is like, get out of here. That's, you're too far gone, right?
Yes.
But she was saying like, it takes really careful conversations, and you start with like, where can you connect? And so like, okay, I'm, you know, this nanny, you're either, you know, a nanny or mom, and, you know, we care about our kids. Okay. That's what we have in common. We care about our kids. Let's start there. And then it's like the gentle conversations about children, and then maybe about healthcare a little bit, and maybe about, and just like taking a step, like a half a step with them to get from that place you can connect on to the next thing where they can say, oh, I never thought about it that way before, you know? And like that, I think, is the work that all these people are talking about. Like when we talk about this issue, it's like, that's the kind of work we have to do. And most of us don't have the emotional stamina right now to do it. And I think that's the problem.
Yes, you're totally right. You're totally right. Francis Lee writes that our movements should be committed to rooting out supremacy, dogmatism, and unhealthy behaviors inside themselves while fighting for justice in society. And that means prioritizing the building of healthy relationships, both with ourselves and with others, choosing alternatives to rage, and honoring ourselves as whole beings. And I think what's helpful in that, and like, as we've been talking about being in relationship, and like, yeah, you're right, doing the work and being in community does require risk. Like, it's not, I don't know, to disrupt that, the notion of like, I'm gonna fucking butcher it again, Queerlandia or whatever it's called, but like this idea that these spaces are supposed to be entirely safe spaces. It's like, well, they're supposed to be transformative spaces, I think. Like, and it doesn't necessarily mean that they're always going to be always making sure that my needs are met. But I think that should be aspirational, like that making sure that, you know, if I'm being harmed, that my needs are being met as the person who's experiencing harm. But I think at the same time, it's like building, Alicia Garza talks about it like a durable heart, developing and building this like durable heart so that like it can keep her doing the work that she needs to do. The goal is always going to be, how can we personally and collectively get more free, right? And so I think for me, it's like, when I'm caught up in trying to perform my activism the right way, I'm not free to make mistakes, or like, I'm scared people are going to judge me. I'm not good enough to do anything. I'm not worthy enough to even do this podcast. Like, it just, it's like all the things that are actually happening in the world aren't being seen for what they are. And I'm living in kind of an alternate reality. And so I want to offer some antidotes for how we can quell that not doing enough voice, but also speak to the public performance piece and all of these interwoven difficulties that a lot of the times I think we know and we feel deep down. So Francis Lee writes, so much of modern activism is public performance, amplified by lightning quick churn of the internet. What does it tell us about the condition of our hearts when we are reactive and not engaging in slow contemplation? And so in the spirit of like slow contemplation, I'm going to be challenging myself to dig a bit deeper, so that when I'm saying like, I'm not doing enough, I'm asking myself, well, according to who, like, what's my standard of enough? And I mentioned this before, the difference between not doing enough and doing what I can, and how you can kind of reframe that idea in your mind to like, think about what gifts you actually have, as opposed to things you actually don't know. Cause it's like, we're all starting from somewhere. We all have something to offer. And back to like Alicia Garza, she shares that she's focused on learning and understanding her responses to trauma and how those learned responses impact her relationships, and her purpose. And she writes, I'm still learning how to deploy these practices in the service of that which I care most about. I learned to cultivate compassion for the brilliant ways I learned to care for myself, and I learned to have agency to determine how I can care for myself today. And I think that's beautiful. Also, Frances talks about how we need to be creating ample space for rage and critique, but also humility and gentleness and understanding. And these are all valid expressions, you know, on the spectrum of human emotions, and that we should be honoring our full humanity, especially the parts of ourselves that aren't in alignment yet with our liberatory values. Because, I don't know, like, part of that just sounds like having some humility and gentleness and vulnerability, which we've been talking about this entire episode, is like that fear comes from feeling like I can't show people who I really am. And then Dean Spade writes, like, there's just so many beautiful things from this anthology. So Dean Spade writes, when we're finding ourselves obsessing over an opinion or story or judgment, we can also ask what else is true. So, you know, asking ourselves, if somebody's doing something that's wrong or that I perceive to be not good enough, who am I telling about this person's behavior? Am I campaigning? Am I mocking that person? Am I being cruel? Am I building my obsession over someone's faults? And as well, like, that we live in a culture and a society of disposability. And, you know, this piece coming back to, like, humility and compassion for ourselves and compassion for other people as being the antidotes to disposability culture. And I love that because it asks us to interrogate and look inward. And before we move outward to, like, condemn or judge other people, because, baby, it's hard. I think so much of what I've realized is when I'm pushing things out there, it says more about me as a person. Like, sometimes things are just independent of how I feel about myself, and I'm just like, this is what I believe, or this is how I think the world should be, and it has nothing to do with me. But a lot of the times, how I feel about other people is like a mirror up to myself, but I don't want to look. And it's like, girl, you gotta look. You have to look in the mirror.
That really reminds me of a quote that I pulled from Alicia Garza's essay in the same anthology, where she says, like, you were talking about how she has a practice to look at herself and to deal with her trauma. And she said, I practice not to be perfect, happy, or joyful, although I'm grateful if and when being happy or joyful is an unintended consequence of my practice. I practice in order to feel, to look squarely at what is. I look courageously at my flaws, my sadness, my fear of disappointing people, my own disappointment, because I want to have a heart that is durable and resilient, that breaks apart and can be put back together again.
I want to end with that. That's good. That's good to me. We could talk about this forever. So
yeah,
that's a beautiful quote. Hey everyone, it's Nick.
And Lala.
If you've been listening to Scene and you like what you hear,
please share us with your friends.
Subscribe to the podcast.
Follow us on Instagram at Scene the Podcast.
Write a review and just tell us what you think.
And help make this work sustainable by supporting Scene the Podcast on Patreon.
We need our beautiful community, and we cannot do this without you.